I'm doing okay with, you know, not messing the part up. So it smells right, it looks right, it sounds right. That's all the inputs I have, so I'm going to continue on with it. So as crazy as that sounds, Larry, I understand what the man was trying to say, because that there is truth to that, a whole lot of truth to it. And coincidentally, when the guy brought the titanium stock out here to do machining on, he handed me an MSDS sheet with the bar stock. And I don't know if you know anything about MSDS, but it's a material safety data sheet. And it tells you all of the hazards that come with that material. Cancer causing, respiratory issues, da-da-da. Gives you first aid treatment and that kind of stuff. But, I read through the hazmat sheet thinking the guy was joking. But, extremely dangerous material as far as inhalation hazard and extreme fire hazard, which I quickly learned. But, I get it. I do. I know it sounds crazy, but there's some truth to that.
JI4DOS. As long as I've enjoyed it, I'm going to jump out of here. I got to get up early again in the morning. I'm going to go check my eyelids for pinholes. We'll say 73 to the group, KK4JBQ, KO4NUE, K4OYM, and anybody else that's listening. Oh, y'all have a good night and a great day tomorrow, and I'll see you on the radio. KI4DOS.
Sir.
Good night, Gary. 7-3.
BQ. Gary, it was a pleasure to have a little QSO with you tonight and the rest of the group. You get some good rest. You're doing a mighty good thing. KK4JBQ.
So, you know, I mean, you can contest to that, running track hose and things like that. I mean, you can definitely relate to, you know, the equipment making a certain sound and knowing when you've got it loaded right and things like that. But, you know, most equipment, from my experience, just functions a little better when it's under load. Determining how much load or how little of a load, that's always the question. And I guess that's with anything.
About that MSDA data sheets too. Boy, D-Heck. Oh man, they'd have a fit if they only knew what was buried down there on I-85 across there on Fair Forest Road across from the Spartanburg DMV. Now, where Long Mile Rubber Company used to be, they, that glue that they had to glue the recap on the, truck tires, it couldn't freeze, and they had, probably about 155-gallon barrels out there in this one building, this bought building that, stayed heated. And for some reason, they lost the power one night, and all of that glue froze. And they called my boss man, and he sent me out there to dig a hole and bury that stuff. I mean, I'd hate to think I'd roll in barrels off in that hole, and the lids would pop off of them. And I started getting a headache. I finally got them all in there and covered up and graded the top of the hole off. Went out there and lugged the excavator up. And Chad, that's the drunkest I ever been in my life from smelling that glue. I have buried all kind of hazardous material. I went down to Oconee Nuclear Power Plant down there. I was running an excavator with a claw on it, and we demoed a building down there that was full of asbestos pipe. Well, we were supposed to haul that stuff down to Barnwell, down there to where they bury all that hazardous stuff, because this stuff was also radioactive, and they didn't tell us nothing about it. We wasn't even wearing a paper mask or nothing, and we didn't have enough truck drivers. I was running the excavator and loading the dump trucks, and they had found this old farmer out there in Slab Town that had this big old ravine washed out there in the pasture, and he agreed to let us haul all of that material in there and dump it as long as we backfilled that big ravine and covered it all up. It's a thousand wonder I ain't glowing green in the dark, Chad. I have buried all kind of hazardous material.
Well, that's interesting. But talking about green glowing stuff, let me tell you a little story. Switch gears here for a second. So when I first joined the military, we went on training down at Fort Stewart, Georgia. And that's near, I think it's upstream from the Savannah nuclear plant. And I got put on guard duty at the position we were when we were doing our training. And got put on guard duty right outside of the position. And it was an awful shift. I mean, it was like from midnight to 4 in the morning. Just, you know, the new guy always gets the worst shift. And the platoon sergeant and the first sergeant were, you know, you got to go through an initiation when you get through your training and you join the unit. And if they don't pick on you, they don't like you. Well, they put me out on the guard position, foxhole, manning the foxhole, and it gets pretty boring out there, you know. And you mind, you know, place tricks on you. You know, you see or hear something, and you know, you got a rifle, but it's blanks, you know, for training. And the first sergeant and platoon sergeant for the initiation with the new guys is they put them on that awful shift, and usually around 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, the first sergeant carried what he called a Wang box, and that was W-A-N-G. And what it was a piece of leather shoelace, but it was, I don't know where they got it. It was 6 or 8 feet long. And they took a number 10 food service can, the big cans, and you cut the lid out of it, they get the food out of it. But then the other end, they poked the hole and run that leather string through it. And I'm on guard duty. And a couple of the soldiers took the green glowing chem lights, and they break the little glass ampule in it and shake it up. Well, they cut the lid off of it and just pour it all over their arms and their chest, and, you know, dribble it down their chest. And the first sergeant would come out there with that Wang box, and he'd hold that tin can and pull that string through it. And when he pulled that string through that number 10 can, it made the awfulest noise. I mean, it sounded like the creature from the Black Lagoon. And then a couple of them soldiers had run out with that green glowing chem light stuff all over them, waving their arms, and this thing making awful noise. Well, you know, every soldier's got 3 general orders, and one of them is, I will guard my post and quit my post only when properly relieved. General Order Number 3. Well, let me tell you, this old country boy, I fled as fast as I could. I left and was scared to death. And boy, they give me a hard time. Oh, they give me such a hard time. But you were talking about being green and glowing. I figured I'd share that with you. I never will forget that walk.
I'm in the floor, Chad. I know about that guard duty. I was always the new guy. I got the 12 to 4 watch. And I was stationed out there at the Pacific Missile Range. That's where we were shipping all the Sidewinders and Sparrow missiles out to Vietnam. And NASA had a tracking station up on Laguna Peak, this mountain out there. And down there in Southern California, there's no trees on the mountain. It's just tumbleweeds and jackrabbits. And I had that 12 to 4 watch up there on Laguna Peak. And like you said, all you had was your piece. And I didn't even have blanks to go in it. But, you know, I smoked cigarettes. So I opened up that butt plate on the stock and took the cleaning kit out and poked me 4 or 5 cigarettes up in there. And a lighter. And I got up there walking around every once in a while. That satellite dish, you talking about moaning and groaning when that thing turned, tracking a satellite or something, it scared the tar out of you. Well, I'm up there by myself, and it was a good 10 miles down to the base. About 1 o'clock in the morning, I opened that butt plate out, got me a Marlboro, and fired it up. And there was one phone up there on the post outside. That phone rang, and I went over and picked the phone up. Hello? Bradshaw, put that cigarette out. They seen the fire from that cigarette all the way back down to that base, Chad.
We're talking about hazardous materials. I guess that was one topic. I'm reflecting now on my time as a jeweler. And this is before asbestos was understood to be as dangerous as we all know it is. And before, this was, I guess, in the early 70s. Before they stopped renovating properties without asbestos containment or remedial removal of asbestos in building materials. It's added a lot of cost, but of course it's necessary. It's a carcinogen for sure. Well, I used an oxyacetylene torch quite a lot because the metals I worked with, silver, gold, platinum, those metals required a lot of heat. Platinum upwards of 3,000 degrees, but only on a very small area. So we put our workpiece on the asbestos pad, and we have to work under 10 power magnification. So I was within 2 inches of the work. My nose was within 2 inches of the work while I fired this up and melted the platinum. What I wasn't aware of is that asbestos by this point was glowing. It won't catch fire, but it will glow red under 3,000 degree heat. Oh, and also, Chad, working with machinery, you probably have used cleaners of some sort. Did you ever use chlorotoluene?
Oh, Larry, I can't cannot recall. I do remember when I first joined, we had 5-gallon buckets of benzene, or methyl, no, benzene, and 1 year we got a shipment in of methyl ethyl ketone, which is, just horrible stuff. I mean, absolutely horrible. And they would use it to clean the breeches out on the self-propelled howitzers. And it did a really good job. I mean, a really good job. But it just filled the turret full of that awful, awful smell. And, you know, you get headaches and just, you know. But now, when I first got in, you know, environmental stuff wasn't that big a deal. You did what you had to do, get stuff clean or whatnot. But throughout my training in the military, we went through hazardous material training and how to properly clean up a spill and dispose of, you know, the Army got real green there for one, 6 or 8 years after I got in, and they really do the best they can to, you know, keep the environment clean as possible, believe it or not. And they're pretty particular about it, actually. But, so we had to go through all of the storage facilities and collect all that stuff and properly dispose of it. So I am pretty particular about what products I use in the shop because, you know, when you are cutting material, it off-gasses what material you use for lubricant. And, you know, you're stuck there in front of the machine having to smell it and be in contact with your skin. So, I'm pretty particular about that. And I use a chemical called Lubrisol, which is water soluble. And it's very low. It has no Sera-3 components in it, which is, you know, carcinogens. So, yes, I do use cleaning stuff, but I'm pretty particular about what I use, you know, because I don't want to be stuck in the shop smelling it all day.
So, trichloroethylene is essentially a degreaser. So I use it a lot in degreasing. I'm also trained to repair mechanical cameras, not so much cameras that you'd find in the marketplace today, but strictly mechanical devices. And you'd have to clean it, re-lubricate it, and adjust it, the CLA. You may have heard of that acronym. Trichloroethylene is awful to breathe, but then if you're cleaning it with no protection for your hands, you can absorb it right through your skin. Bad stuff. Anyway, I'm probably full of it. So all of us have lived through the technological eras of ignorance, and we know better now. So, well, I'm still kicking, and you're still kicking. We're all still kicking, bless your heart. KK4JBQ.
Walt, you want it? If not, I'll take it.
My amphotericin ain't starting to work on me. I've got my flashlight here. I'm ready to wander back up to the house, and Yeri's done made me tired. So I'm going to say 7-3s to Larry, KK4JBQ, and Chad, KO4NUE. This is K4OIM. I'm going to get up there like Gary, and I'm going to check my eyelids for tracks. I've enjoyed it, Larry, and really enjoyed it, Chad. Always fun to talk to you. 7-3s to both of you. Good night. God bless.
Oh, be safe, and I'll talk at you later.
Don't let the back button bite. KK4JBQ.
KO4NUE, KK4JBQ. Well, Larry, here we are again.
Two men standing.
Exactly. So I thought it was neat with what John said tonight about putting AK's call sign on the radio for in memoriam, I guess. But after he said that, I was thinking, the first thought that came to my mind was the tools in the toolbox, in my toolbox. And one of the tools in there is a special wrench that's used to adjust a valve train on a deuce and a half engine. And my first mentor when I joined the military in the maintenance section, which is where I started off, you're assigned, your platoon sergeant is your mentor. And you, because of the nature of the equipment that we dealt with, as far as, you know, how expensive it was, you know, you didn't just turn a private loose on a, you know, $1 million piece howitzer. You know, you had to mentor with the platoon sergeant, and that was usually about a 2-year process. And if we got more than one trainee in at once, the platoon sergeant had the pick of the litter, I guess. And then the squad leaders would take the other trainees, because typically you don't want too many trainees with a leader. You want to, it's their opportunity to pass along what they know, and it's their opportunity to teach you, not necessarily the right way, but the way they want it done. And there is a difference there. But my first mentor was Barney Cooley. And, oh, man, I'm going to tell you, what an experience. He was, and I mean, it was not a bad experience. Don't misunderstand what I'm saying. He was just, he was a wonderful man and a wonderful teacher. Now, he would break it off in you if you deserved it. And I got in trouble, not trouble, but I just got into mischief a couple of times. And, I could tell you some of the stuff that just, you know, I just stayed in mischief. And I stayed with him for 2 years. And he gave me my first toolbox. And just how he conducted himself and held me accountable for what I did right and for what I did wrong. Absolutely amazing. But I had been working for him for 2 years, and we knew it was a, you know, trainees know it's a 2-year mentorship. So you just kind of lose track of the time, you know. You just get kind of comfortable with where you are and what you're doing. But I remember my 2 years ended on a tank trail one night about 2:00 in the morning, and howitzer broke down, and the gun crew got out, and I was in the maintenance truck, and Barney, my platoon sergeant, was in the Humvee behind me, and I got out of the truck with my toolbox, and he said, "All right, I'm gonna leave you with it." And I said, "No, what do you mean you're gonna leave me with it? You can't leave me out here with this thing." And he said, "No." Nah. He says, "You've had all the training I can give you." And You know, I'm going to go on with the unit, and you stay right here. All I can tell you is you know what you're doing, and don't come back till it's fixed. So, the crew chief got out and watched Barney drive off, and he just looked at me, and, you know, he says, "Oh, man," he says, I can't believe this, and kind of hurt my feelings for a little bit, but I just remember firing right back to him. I may not be the best, but right now I'm all you got. So, I just was really pleased with John and his idea. That was a really good idea.
JBQ. Oh my. I've not been in that situation, but I've been in situations that remind me so much of that. Yeah, I suppose in one working life, whether you're a soldier or a civilian, you will come across people that earn your respect. I can name them and reminisce about them. But just to say, I know what you're talking about. I do. At some point, I'm going to have to do a battery change. This thing is... There's a red light that glows on the HT when it's starting to run out of juice. Anyhow. Just talking about Mac again, I have, even today, I mean, I know he's gone. He was in his 70s and still working when I knew him. And this was back in the 80s, from late 70s through early 80s. So I know he's bound to be gone now. But I gained so much respect for the man. One curious thing about Mac, he called it to my attention once, made me real self-conscious. Mac, see, it seems that he could handle work pieces and not show a sign of dampness in his fingers, his hands. He didn't sweat. Now me, especially if I'm a little bit challenged, you might say, by the work in front of me, he was... I got to explain that he was one of the individuals that worked on me when I was in my 6-year apprenticeship. I was apprenticed in making jewelry, repairing watches and clocks and that sort of thing. But he would notice that I got sweaty hands, and that just won't do. He says, you've got to keep a towel in your lap and keep your hands dry. Made me real self-conscious. But anyway, I mean, you'll understand what I mean when I say I love the man. I did. Like a brother, like a father. And I had tremendous respect for him. And I hope he's hearing that right now. KK4 JBQ.
Get it. And Larry, you just, you let me know when you got to change that battery out. But, I do. I understand. Those men are hard to find, and as the men that can do it right are even harder to find. And you know, when you find somebody that's like that, that's willing to pass on really any kind of knowledge, you know, I think one important lesson that he taught me, and I've talked with you about this before, is that, you know, just because a mentor does not choose, well, the mentor is not going to waste his time on an apprentice that is not willing to listen and learn. And I think my grandfather taught me that lesson at an early age, is that, you know, you you have to be willing to listen, and not only listen, but apply what I am trying to teach you. If you don't do that, then I'm gonna turn you loose, and when you fall flat on your face, I'm gonna let you fall. He said, and I'll be there to pick you up, but I will let you fall, and you're gonna have to learn that. And I learned that very young with him, and he was able to teach me that where my father was not. And I'm not saying anything negative about my father, but Pappy just had a way about him. I don't know how to explain it, but he was able to teach me that at a young age. So by the time I went through my training and moved into the mentorship with Barney at the shop, I knew exactly where my place was. And in a lot of ways, the apprentice has a responsibility to show that to the mentor first thing right off of the bat. And to show him that he's listening and he's willing to apply, and then offer a way to not only just tell him that I understand what you're saying, but show him. And I don't know. I just, Pappy taught me that at a young age, and Barney was good at supporting that, I guess, as far as my mentor goes. But that was an amazing experience with him, and I can honestly say those type of people are really hard to find, really hard. And you just, have to kind of cherish that when you get a hold of it.
I agree with all my heart and soul. And you have to feel yourself fortunate if you are thrown together. This isn't something you can, apply for. This isn't something that you see coming. But you know it, the instant you find someone that works well with people, that's a skill. That's an important skill. And very few people have that. Honestly, they're... and I'm not saying they can show you the right way to do something or instill in you the respect that you need for the work and the materials that you're working with. That's necessary. But someone who has almost a charming way to do the work, whatever it is. And I've had a few people like that. I'm going to change my battery now. And when I come back, I want to talk about the other side of the coin. KK4JBQ.
Be listening.
JBQ.
Go ahead, Larry.
The coin is someone that you're thrown together with who has no intention to hear you out on anything. They don't like where they are. They don't like who they're with. Or at least that's the impression that you get. And it puts me, when this happened to me the first time, I'll never forget it. It put me in an awful position because I thought, well, why are they here? What am I to do with this person? Have you ever been there? KK4JBQ.
Absolutely. And I, just as soon as you said that, I got one person that came to my mind, and it was such a horrible experience, actually, that my wife, I mean, that's a household name in here, and it was years and years and years ago, but it was such a horrible experience that the lesson that when that name comes up in the house, well, how do I say this? So we have given the lesson a name, and that name is his name. I won't say his name. He's not an amateur radio operator or anything. But he was a leader, and it was horrible. I mean, just horrible. And but I tell you, as bad as that experience was for me, there's still a lesson in there. And that lesson for me was that taught me exactly what not to be as a leader and a person. And that in itself is a valuable lesson. And that teaches you, you know, just exactly what I said, what not to be.
That can be just as valuable a lesson to you. So I'll fill in some gaps here. I was working at a jeweler in Richmond, Virginia. The name don't matter. But they've been in business as a family-owned business since the end of the Civil War. 1865 is when they were founded. They were known all over Central Virginia. And being in the capital city, they had all kinds of customers with plenty of money. And I was fortunate, really, to be employed right off the street. You know, I had some experience, but gracious, they were somehow impressed in the interview, which was unique, because being a family-owned business, their relationship with their employees was unique in my experience in the working world. They treated you like a member of the family. That was unusual. I had worked in many places by that time because I drifted a lot. But working for a family business became one of my favorite things to do just because of that experience. Well, we had a shop, a three-man shop, in the retail jewelry store. And we were located diagonally from the front door. So if anybody had a repair or an appraisal that they wished, or if they wanted a special piece made with castings and all of that, then they had to travel through every other part of the store to get to it. I always thought that was thought out. Anyway, we were going to be training a new employee, I was told. I wasn't told anything else. So she came on board the next day, and right away I saw she had an attitude, and I was told to show her how to engrave. We had a pentagraph type of engraving machine. You might call it scratch engraving rather than engrave with gravers, where you remove metal with a tool, a small hand tool. This was scratching the engraving in, and you know, you had to mount the piece in the machine and get all your blanks lined up for the line of text that you wanted to put on there. Oh boy. And I could see right away that she was not very interested. She wasn't following what I was doing, because I was going to ask her to repeat it, you know, I mean, right away. It wasn't that difficult, you know. And she gave me all kinds of grief until we had a little conversation, and I asked her straight up. I said, for gracious sake, why did you want to work here and do this? It doesn't seem like you have any interest at all. And she was an attractive, young, 20-something, an attractive young female who wanted to work on the sales floor. Now, the idea, and I knew this well enough, the idea was that before you worked on the sales floor and interacted with customers, you would know everything. You would work in the shop, taking items in and returning them to customers. Of course, that's the very first thing you do. And then you'd work with some of the machinery, you know, the simple stuff. Get to know the nomenclature of all the materials that would be handled. You'd have that background. And it's really a crash course. She wouldn't be with us for many days, of course. When I learned that, I was clued in. But she didn't last the day. I felt bad about it, but in a way, I thought, okay, so I gave her a heads up. This is the environment she was going to be in. She'd have to know the business and to be able to talk with customers. You can't sell, I don't know what she sold before. But no matter what your skills are, you can't work in some trades and some businesses without understanding the product. And jewelry is, well, it's a specialty, let's say. KK4JBQ.
So, I mean, I get it. You have to know all the ins and outs before you can intelligently speak with a customer when they come in the door. So, I mean, that makes sense. But as far as the attitude goes, man, I tell you, yeah, that makes all the difference. You know, you got somebody that's just not interested in what you're trying to what you're trying to pass them on. You know, that says a lot about the person, too, and that, you know, more than likely they probably don't have a whole lot of pride in what they're doing. And, you know, I learned real quick that, you know, when I got out on my own, that I was not going to be a rich person. And quite honestly, I can truthfully say I am not a person motivated by money. I mean, don't get me wrong, I enjoy what it can do for me, but that has never been a driver for me at all. I have just, that's just not my cup of tea. I enjoy the, you know, the wrenches and the tooling that it can allow me to express myself and take pride in what I'm doing. And when you have someone who's not interested in that, then, you know, I'm personally not going to waste my time on them, because it's just not going to work. But when you're stuck in a situation to where you're trying to teach somebody something and you don't have the ability to say, okay, well, you know, move on to the next station, because you and I are not, you're not, you know, when you don't have a choice about that, that's a miserable situation. And you just, you know, it starts to affect you as a person, or it would affect me. I mean, I get it, but I have experienced that on both ends. You know, people above me and then people below me as I moved up in rank. But that's, you know, one of the things about the military is when you get a certain amount of rank on you, you know, the people that come in under you for mentorship, they really don't have a choice. I mean, they signed up to do this, and, you know, they have to do it. But every now and then you got one that was just a hard case and just wasn't going to pay attention. And I learned not when I became an NCO, probably more toward the senior side, that when I encountered soldiers like that, you know, there's no sense being, you know, making them do it. Let's see if we can find a connection. And, you know, let's drop it down a little bit and move off a task, and let's make the connection first. And usually, I learned that if I was able to make a connection over a period of time, we could move into the task at hand to be trained on, and made it a much more enjoyable experience, and for them as well. And ultimately, that was the goal, was that, you know, some circumstances are just absolutely miserable. It doesn't matter what you try to do. It's just the nature of what you do. And, you know, you just have to accept that. But most of the time, you could find a way to share a connection with one another. And, you know, that just made things a whole lot easier. But that's another one of those, you know, apprentice mentorship lessons, you know, that you learn from a mentor. It's not just the job that you're learning. It's all aspects of it. And one thing Barney explained to me, and I've never forgotten, was that if you take your job and you divide it, if you imagine like it's a piece of the pie, like a pie, and you cut that pie up into pieces. Okay, so here's the paperwork portion, here's the ethic portion, here's the job, here's the this, here's that, all the mechanics of it. They're individual pieces of pie. But, and I remember him telling me, don't ever forget that you have individual pieces that you have to complete, and other people have to help you complete those, put those pieces, complete those pieces of that pie. And don't ever forget that all of those pieces are attached by a crust. And that crust is the people, or the people that you're working with and the people that you work for. So if you understand that and understand how people work and how to make a connection, then you're going to be a whole lot better off. And he not only told me that, but he demonstrated that to me. And he would tell me from time to time, this is one of those times where here's the crust. We got to get this done and this done and this done, and here's how we're going to do it. And we're going to pull those individuals and make a connection and get them to help complete this task, because you cannot do this by yourself. And that was an amazing lesson, and I never forgot it.
4NUE, KK4JBQ. Well, I've just been thinking about that one experience, and I think differently about it. You know, that was many years ago, and I think differently about it at different stages in my life. Now, I can plainly tell you that she was probably a very good salesperson and hired on the strength of her performance as a salesperson. She was, I'll admit, she was the first trainee that was ever brought into that department while I was there. She was the first. And so I couldn't, I didn't have what I would later acquire, the talk. If you have a fellow employee that is just not working out, there's a talk that you can have. And that talk would rightly be an encouragement to tell me what you think your strengths are. Why were you attracted to this business? Are you, you know, we could have had a little banter, a little back and forth, and I could get around to explaining what I would later learn but didn't have this at the time. I would explain to her that she needs to know the product so well that no customer could embarrass her with a question about the product being sold. You just have to know more than any customer would ask you. But you had to be sparing, that is to say, dribble out that information only as necessary. Because you can lose a sale right away over explaining the benefits of the products or the drawbacks of the products or the, you know, answering questions. I would learn this over time. And it's so easy with jewelry. It is just so easy. Learn how to handle folks who came in with... I had a lady come in once, Chad, and she wanted some earrings made. And so we would have a conversation about the stones that she brought in that she'd like mounted in the earrings. And she said to me, she says, now, and she leaned in closer. She says, now, I hope you realize that I need one earring a little below the other. And I was just struck. I couldn't understand how that would matter, one earring a little lower than the other. And so she backed away and she says, okay, take a look at me. She had one earlobe that was lower than the other, and I would never have noticed that. So I says, certainly we can do that. She wanted drop earrings. Certainly we can do that. But you know, I got to tell you that nobody notices this. And we had a real warm conversation about her self-consciousness. And I felt really good afterwards. Made the earrings and she loved them. And I made them just as she required, just as she requested. I made them just as she requested. You learn things every day. Working with people, working with the general public. It's different than working just with machinery or working in a service capacity like you were, thrown together with people who, you know, they signed up, here's the job to do, put your shoulder to it. It's marvelous that this world's made up of different things like that. KK4JBQ.
BQ, KO4NUE. So, yeah, I think probably she knew, and she felt like it was an issue. But, you know, the other thing, too, is, you know, women notice things like that. I don't think men are notice things as much like that. Or I know I don't. I notice other things that you know I'm good at, or you know, my wife comments all the time. You know, I can listen to a car going down the road and know this, you know, what's going on with it and this, that, and the other. And she's kind of like, well, how in the world do you know things like that? And then on the other hand, you know, she, when my children were growing up, she knew things, would notice things about them that I had no clue, you know, just absolutely no clue. But she, I mean, I guess the customer in question, she probably knew it. But just little details like that that make that situation what it is. I remember one lesson that Barney taught me is I had really messed up. We were doing a set of gear hubs or something on a Humvee, and it wasn't that I didn't pay attention to what he was telling me, how to assemble the gear hub a certain way. I legitimately just missed it. But the problem is, I did 8 of them this way, and it was clearly wrong. And I mean, safety hazard wrong. And I had rebuilt 8 of the gear hubs and put bearing and race in backwards. And those gear hubs, you know, have a little tag that you put on the gear hubs that says, hey, built with pride by, you know, Sergeant Hightower and the date. And one of the gear hubs went on one of his trucks at his unit. And, I mean, it came apart in the parking lot. And he, you know, saw my sticker on it. And, I mean, it was months afterwards. And he made me pull it off the truck and put it on the table and said, you understand why this is a problem. And, I mean, we had to go dig through the paperwork and figure out how many I had built and what trucks they got sent to. And one of them ended up down in Columbia. And, oh man, I had to go explain to the command what I, you know, this is what's happened. And fix them on the spot. I mean, he made me take my toolbox, which was the right thing to do. I'm not complaining. It was the right thing to do. But the whole point of this conversation is that after I had corrected the deficiency with the 8 gear hubs, Barney called that redemption, just like I said on the net tonight. I want an opportunity to redeem myself when I messed up the preamble. Well, that was a lesson Barney taught me, and he called it redemption. When you make a mistake, if you do nothing about it, then you're going to be worse off than if you admit it and try to redeem. At least people will say, well, at least he did the right thing and admitted and corrected it. That's better than doing nothing. But I remember him telling me out in the motor pool, and it was about midday. And I'll never forget that because he put me in the sun. He put his back to the sun and put my face into the sun while he was lecturing me. And after the conversation about redemption, he told me, this is another piece of the crust. And one day you will be a mentor, and when you are, and you're teaching a lesson to someone, you put their son in the face, so you put their face in the sun so that they struggle to maintain eye contact with you, because this argument is a struggle and it's a lesson, and everything about it needs to be a lesson, and that includes you need to struggle even listening to what your mentor says and let the sun detract your vision a little bit. Because he would tell me, no, don't pull your bill on your hat down, look at me, don't look at the ground, look at me. And I just remember thinking, I can't look at you because the sun is so bright. But that was part of his lesson. And, oh, man, I mean, just, I can't tell you how many times I used that in my career. Not to be just demonstrative, but just to drill into that person like he did me, in a way that, you know, the lesson in itself was a struggle so that you don't ever forget it. That's what I'm trying to say. And I think the woman with the ears, she knew it was an issue, and that's all that mattered.